If you enjoy The Spectator's podcast, why not subscribe to the magazine as well? You can get 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12, plus a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. This is a podcast-only deal, and we hope you take us up on it.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, The Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts, and today we are delighted to be joined by Julian Bagini. Julian is a philosopher, journalist, and author of over 20 books. He has served as the academic director of the Royal Institute of Philosophy and is a member of the Food Ethics Council. His latest book, How the World Eats, A Global Food Philosophy, is published by Granta and out now. Julian, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you for having me, Olivia.
We're going to start where we always do, at the very beginning, and ask you, what are your earliest memories of food?
Well, I think the earliest memory of a meal which I really enjoyed was shepherd's pie. It was probably a cottage pie, if you're going to be pedantic, but in our household, we called it shepherd's pie. And I don't know, as like a 4 or 5 year old, I loved this. And I remember I had a birthday party, and it was what I wanted to have for the party. It's just that sort of savory meatiness. And I loved the way the potato got really crispy on the top, and yeah, that little crust. So yeah, shepherd's pie was my first food love, I think.
And is it still something you love now?
No.
You described it so beautifully.
Yeah, I know. It's strange, isn't it? I would enjoy a well-made one, that's for sure. But it's not something I think of cooking. It's not a combination that I kind of crave anymore.
You don't have it for your birthday parties?
No. Maybe I should.
I think that's quite chic, actually, shepherd's pie for your birthday party in 2024, or cottage pie. Your mother was English, but your father was an Italian immigrant. Did that influence the way you ate at home when you were growing up?
Yes, it did. It meant we ate in a very strange way for a kind of East Kent sort of working class family in the 1970s, because a lot of what we ate was the same old rubbish. I mean, the 70s was a terrible decade for food, I think, you know. All this really, you know, dried things. You have these soups which were made out of gnaw cubes, literally dried cubes. You chuck them into water and that was meant to be a course of a meal. And there are these horrible products people have forgotten, like this thing called Rise and Shine, which was a powder. It was like to give you the glamour of orange juice for breakfast, but orange juice is very expensive then. You just stirred up this powder in water. There's a lot of that kind of stuff. But my mum had also absorbed some Italian influences. So we did get kind of, you know, a spaghetti bolognese, which was, well, it was still not an authentic one, but it's a bit closer to the Italian version than the things that my friends are eating with their huge chunks of carrot and things like that. So yes, there was that kind of influence, but it was a sort of hybrid-y type thing we had.
Were you interested in food as a child? Were you at your mother or father's apron strings whilst they were cooking, or was it just part of the background?
Well, I think I must have been, yeah. I mean, I took an interest in various aspects of food fairly young. I mean, I did become aware of what was supposed to be healthy for us, you know, and I was encouraging, you know, our household to switch to wholemeal bread from, you know, white bread when my mum wasn't really that interested in it at the time. And I was trying to have breakfast cereals that, you know, were healthier, which is a very relative term given how loaded with sugar they all were. But I also, you know, I did get into cooking and stuff. And we would do a bit of baking and make some cakes. And I did learn to make things like that, spaghetti bolognese and things. So I did have that kind of interest. The other thing is I don't think I have a good word for it in English. I think the best one is trencherman. I mean, I always enjoyed eating and, you know, at times enjoyed eating too much. It was always a big pleasure for me.
That's such a nice way of framing it. I think when I try to describe myself, I always say slightly self-deprecating, I'm greedy, but that's not really how I feel about food. I think it is this sort of really wide-ranging pleasure of eating, even really aside from cooking, to be honest with you.
It's really interesting because Italians, I mean, different cultures have different sort of vocabularies. And in Italian, they've got much better words for this. So you can say you're goloso, which really means like throaty. And it's kind of like where we would say greedy, but it doesn't have that critical connotation. And they also say una buona forchetta, which is literally a good fork. You know, these are kind of quite endearing terms for someone who likes to eat, you know, maybe a bit too much, but hey, you know, that's okay.
I like that a lot. How did school food compare to home food when you were growing up?
Oh God, it was dreadful. I loathe school dinners, as we call them. English vocabulary about lunch and dinners and teas. It's so complicated. School dinners at primary school were awful. I couldn't wait to get packed lunches at secondary school. My mum made me try the school dinners there for a bit. But we had, our primary school was dreadful. Our school dinners came from another school up the road. So they came in these huge kind of vats and trays at about, you know, 10:30, 11 in the morning. And then they sat around to be served up. And, grizzle in the beef and huge lumps in the potato. We sometimes had pasta and it was literally a big lump. They had to like cut it out like it was polenta or solid polenta.
And what did Gillian's 1970s packed lunch look like? What were you eating on a daily basis then?
Well, I was in the 80s for that. Well, it's a regulation. I don't know. I think every parent in the country is sort of issued with a government instruction on what a packed lunch consists of. And it changes slightly. They slightly update it every year. It's a bit like the basket of goods by which they calculate inflation. It has to have like a round of sandwiches, made from sliced bread, cut into triangles or rectangles, actually. And the filling has got to be something like ham or cheese, tuna if you're posh. You have to have an apple or a banana, a packet of crisps. And at that time, you might have a small like penguin chocolate biscuit, something like that. Certainly not a big one. And then
nothing
at secondary
rogue.
School, actually, yeah, a bit rogue. At secondary school, actually, a lot of people would also have a little yogurt, actually, which is interesting. Which would get very warm during the day.
Delicious. Just slightly more fermented. Tell us about leaving home. So you went to Reading University. Were you living on your own, cooking for yourself then? Were you in halls? What did food look like for you when you first left home?
Well, the first year was in halls, which again was a fairly grim experience for food. But, we put up with it. The second year, we lived in a very, very unusual house. There were five of us in the house, and four of us basically always cooked together. Once a week, we'd go to the supermarket, and we'd always eat together. We'd plan the meals. And we didn't know any other household where the students did that. So we did cook every day. I mean, looking back on it, again, it's a bit like my childhood. Compared to the way most people are eating, we were probably having a very healthy, balanced diet. But compared to the way I'd like to eat today, I feel fairly horrified, Partly because, we were buying very cheap ingredients and things, But yeah, but we did do that. And it was a nice thing about the house, that we would every day sit and eat together. And I think it really helped us to bond as a group. And there's still a group of people that I see today, still in touch with, and we get together. And when we get together, what do? We eat, of course.
And at what stage did becoming a philosopher become a sort of viable career path? You took a doctorate. Was that with the intention of becoming a professional academic, or was it a route to something else? What was the path for you?
Well, that's quite interesting. So I wanted to do the doctorate because I felt that I was only just getting into philosophy at the end of my undergraduate degree. In fact, I started on a master's, but in those days you could convert without having to complete the master's first. You couldn't do it now, but I was very naive. I remember having this sort of like epiphany that all my peers were planning to become academics, and I was just doing it because I thought I had three more years of study to do. So I didn't have a plan, and I wasn't too convinced about being an academic for various reasons. So when I left, I kind of did bits and pieces of work, bits of teaching and tutoring. And what I did was I wanted to start a philosophy magazine, because we had this newfangled thing. I'm going to sound like an old fogey. You're making me sound old because I'm remembering things that younger listeners are going to. Do you have younger listeners, though? Maybe you don't.
I hope so.
Anyway, right, sorry, you can cut that out if you want. Anyway, but yes, this newfangled thing called desktop publishing had come along, which was amazing, because when I was an undergraduate at Reading, for the student newspaper, the secretary of the union had to type everything out. We had to cut things up onto paper and paste them onto paper. That's where cut and paste kind of comes from as a phrase. Desktop publishing, if you had a computer and the right bit of software and you could afford a print one, anyone could make a magazine which could look half decent. So I wanted to do this, and I eventually teamed up with another guy who was on this tutorial college teaching circuit who was into the internet and also could manipulate digital images. And together we started this thing called the Philosopher's Magazine. And again, very naive, no real sort of plan, and obviously not a way to make money. But what that meant was it kind of created a platform for myself in which I could say I was the editor of the Philosopher's Magazine. You know, junior, junior, PhD, editor of the Philosopher's Magazine.
So Suddenly sounds quite fancy, doesn't it?
I know. Even though I hadn't made up the PhD, but I'd made up the magazine. And that gave me an in. That gave me an in for approaching newspapers and magazines to write things. And, you know, I just gradually was able to write more. So I developed this sort of line as a freelance writer. I also got the opportunity to do a few books. And then it kind of, and I've been about, it's about 20 odd years since I've been completely freelance that way, not relying on other kind of income, like bits of teaching and things.
And what drew you specifically, because you've written about a wide range of philosophical issues, what drew you to the ethics of food?
Well, I think it's just, it is a nice kind of combination of interests. As I say, I mean, I always have this interest in where things had come from. I became vegetarian in my early 20s for a while. So that interest in ethics was there. I was also very aware of, you know, issues around justice and workers. And what happened was, actually about 10 years ago, I wrote my first book on philosophy and food. It was called The Virtues of the Table. Now, that was a very different kind of project. What I was trying to explore there really was the kind of idea that there's this phrase, I think, like Briat Savarin or something, which is like, you know, to know how to eat is to know how to live or something. No, it wasn't Briat Savarin, it was the other one. And that was kind of the idea that actually food plays such an important part in our lives. It touches on everything. It touches on our health, our family, our culture, our traditions, our creativity, justice, ethics, and everything. So the idea of that book was that we could sort of like examine, you know, if we get our approach to food right, it's a way of modelling how we should live more generally. Yes. That got me into the Food Ethics Council, where I became more and more aware of how complex the food system was and just how most of us have a very thin understanding of it. And for me, an ideal project for a book is something where I want to find out more about something. There isn't a nice, easy source which puts it all together. And I think other people might want to know as well. So I kind of do the research and put it together really for my own curiosity and hope that it's actually useful to other people as well.
Tell us about how the world eats, because as you say, it is this, it's a really sprawling topic that you have corralled together. Mm. And what you look at in the book is really wide ranging. You are looking at people and land and animals, you're looking at sort of natural food systems and engineered food systems, the ethics of UPF, the, you know, omnivorism, and everything. How does the world eat? How do you go about putting that into one book that isn't the size of a three-story house?
Yes, okay, good question. Well, you know, I think the idea, what we're looking for in the book is, first of all, to give some kind of sense of the food system as a whole, but also as it's changed over history. So, you know, we start with hunter-gatherers and we also look at pastoralists. But the idea is that the ultimate goal is to try and see, well, are there any things that successful and good sustainable food systems have in common? I mean, there's incredible diversity, but are there any things they have in common? So then you're kind of liberated from the idea that you literally have to cover everything. What you're looking to do is to sort of like cover, and it's always going to be somewhat arbitrary, but, you know, key features of food systems, historical and contemporary, which together kind of cover the major bases in some way and allow us then to have a wide enough view that we can see if there are general principles. So that's the way I did it. And in terms of, obviously, expertise is the issue here, because I don't think there's anyone who's an expert on all the things I talk about in the book. And I haven't become one by writing the book. You know, the way I do it is I kind of call it philosophical journalism, really. I mean, the point about the journalist is that they tend to have a kind of a specialization. So they are kind of experts, but they're not deep experts in everything they're reporting on. Their job is to identify the most reliable experts they can consult, find the key documents, the most reliable documents they can consult, and then they've got to put it together to tell a story to make sense of it to other people. And that's what I'm doing, with the additional factor that I'm also trying to draw out those conceptual links and philosophical links as well.
And what surprised you in the process of researching and writing the book?
Quite a lot. I think actually, strangely, well, maybe not strangely, one of the most interesting things for me, I'm not sure it'd be one of the most interesting chapters for other people, was about aquaculture, fish farming. Because my knowledge of fish farming was, you know, based on I guess, what's been most salient in our reporting about it over recent decades, which is it's pretty dire. I mean, there's some terrible fish farms. I mean, Scottish salmon fish farms. I mean, you'll get people writing in and complaining about this and sticking up for the industry. But there have been, I'm sure there's lots of good practice, but there has been some pretty bad practice. We have these issues with, you know, sea lice infestations. You have these fish farms contaminating wild stocks. It's pretty dire, actually. But what I kind of found out was that it certainly doesn't have to be that way at all. And that fish farming actually goes back thousands of years to China, ancient China, where they developed this fantastic system of having the fish, carp, a kind of carp, in the paddy fields. And it's this wonderful symbiotic relationship. The fish don't need feeding because they're eating the bits of, you know, roots and vegetable matter from the rice. But they're actually also oxidating the water, and their feces are also helping to feed the rice. And it's a beautifully balanced system. And actually, interesting little trivia fact, you do learn interesting trivia along the way too. The world's most farmed fish is carp. Most people would assume it'd be something like salmon. But isn't it? It's carp, because that's the thing they farm all over Asia. And then so today, what we're looking at is there are people who are innovating with fish farming who are trying to make their systems much cleaner. Some of them are trying to do that thing of combining different things which create a symbiotic cycle. So there's stuff around sea bream and clams where you can farm them together and it's more efficient than farming one by itself and you require less external inputs. And also doing fish farming further out to sea where the currents basically deal with the problem of excess waste because everything is constantly being sort of washed away. So I kind of like changed my mind about that. I think the problem is that it's still very difficult to identify how well-sourced your farmed fish is. So actually, in terms of what I personally buy, it hasn't made much difference to my purchasing choices, but it has made me much more aware that, you know, fish farming has got huge benefits if done well. And we're perhaps too aware of all the ways in which it's done badly.
And there's a certain, particularly as you move further through the history, there's a certain urgency to the book in the need to resolve the problems in our food systems, time being of the essence. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, I mean, we could take up the whole time. I mean, if you look at the food system, I mean, it's an interesting one. There's a woman called Tara Garnett who runs this wonderful thing called Table, which is associated with the Oxford Martin School. And they really, it's the one forum I could find where it's genuinely very impartial and balanced. And they try and encourage thoughtful food systems debate. And she put it really well. She compares the current system to like a high-functioning alcoholic, right? Now, a high-functioning alcoholic, in one way, is everything's going fine. They're holding down their job. Yeah, they're bringing in their money. They're doing everything. But underneath that, they have got a deep structural problem, which is not sustainable. And our food system is a bit like that. On the surface, it's doing a bloody good job. We produce more calories per person for the world than the world needs. In developed countries, people generally get access to pretty historically cheap food. I mean, there are people who can't afford food in this country. But to be honest, I don't think that's because food is expensive by any historical measure. It's simply because minimum incomes have got so low because they also can't afford energy or clothes or things either. So it seems to be working well. But on so many counts, soil degradation, I think the WHO was saying that about 90% of the world's soils will be degraded by 2050. Biodiversity loss. Food system is the major driver of biodiversity loss in the world. It's responsible for sort of forests being cleared, which is also a major contributor to greenhouse gases. In terms of health, you have about a third of the world who are undernourished still. And it's not because the food doesn't exist in the world, it's because of the way it's distributed and everything. But at the same time, about another third are suffering from being overweight. And one interesting statistic, which is hard to kind of get the sentence right, but there are more people living in countries where being overweight is a major health problem than are living in countries where being underweight is a major health problem, which is quite extraordinary. So everywhere you kind of look, you know, you've got these real problems. So how long can all this sort of hang together?
And how does it affect the way you interact with food on a daily basis? I think you've previously described yourself as a conscientious carnivore. Is that still the case?
Yes, it is. Yeah. I mean, I think One thing I sort of changed my mind about a bit over the years is that I think we live in a society where we're very much encouraged to think that our primary duty is to basically change our own consumer choices. That's what you should do. You find out about what's good and bad, and then you buy it and you avoid the bad stuff. Now, I do try to do that, but actually those little consumer actions are just not going to solve anything. Unfortunately, it's going to take regulatory change and the right kind of fiscal incentives and all of that kind of stuff. But yes, I do try and eat well, but not obsessively, because I'm just a little pawn in the machine. So if you take meat, so I used to be vegetarian, but I was aware of the obvious sort of problem with being a vegetarian, which is that if animal welfare is your motivation, then the welfare in the dairy industry is often worse than that in the meat industry, actually. So, you know, you're not eating any dead animals, but you could be contributing even more to bad animal welfare than a meat eater who doesn't eat dairy. So I switched. So you could go vegan. We can have a whole discussion about that if you like, but I didn't think that was the right option. So instead, I went for this sort of conscientious omnivore policy where if I'm buying anything from an animal, I try and make sure it's high welfare. And again, I don't eat a lot of meat anyway, but also not being too obsessive about that, because I can't control everything in my food system. And often you're in a situation where by the time it's in front of you, it's done and dusted. So if you don't eat it, it's going to go to waste. So, you know, the fact that it's not sourced perfectly is kind of less important than the fact that things shouldn't be wasted. So that's the kind of way it affects my daily choices.
I recognise that you're coming to this from a philosophical point of view, rather than, you know, a policymaker point of view. But as you say, we are very, very small parts in a food system, and the problem is the food system itself. Is it an intractable problem, or is there something we can we change this?
Yeah, I don't think it's intractable at all. I think that you speak to most people, they kind of know what the vague sort of solutions should be. That the previous government commissioned Henry Dimbleby to produce a national food strategy, which a lot of people might have heard about. And he produced a document which was pretty impressive. I mean, nothing's going to please everybody all of the time. And some people had various quibbles about it. But it was pretty systematic, and it looked at everything, and it was all entirely doable. And, of course, what happened was that government pretty much ignored it and shelved it, acted on virtually nothing. And Dimbleby has since quite rightly expressed his frustration at that. Also, you can look at other countries which do things pretty well. Finland scores very well for its food security, also tends to score very well on other measures too. And they do all sorts of things which help to create a better food system and also better food literacy. So it's a key part of the school curriculum there. And the school meals themselves are considered part of the curriculum. They're meant to be an opportunity for children to learn about food choices, and also about the importance of sharing food together, the conviviality of it, and whatever it might be. So, you know, there are so many levers we can pull. And a lot of the problems are simply that the incentives are wrong for business. People beat up on big business a lot as the enemies in the food system for all the ultra-processed food they're creating and their marketing. And there's no doubt that they have done lots of bad things. Marion Nestle's a very interesting American professor who's book Food Politics has become a kind of a classic in this area. And, you know, she is excoriating about how bad the food industry is. But at the same time, she's absolutely clear that she's not against businesses earning money. And if you only put the right incentives in place, they will change, because they're making this kind of food because that's the most profitable food. And why is it the most profitable food? Partly because a lot of the raw ingredients, you know, a lot of subsidies go into creating things like vegetable oils, rapeseed oils, you know, which are basically best used as these raw ingredients in processed foods. The subsidies aren't going to create wholesome fresh vegetables and fruit, for example.
Tell us about how you eat. What did you have for breakfast this morning?
I unusually had a very late breakfast this morning, actually, just before I came on. Breakfast I find really interesting because, generally speaking, when people eat the same thing for lunch every day, or have the same dinners every sort of Thursday or Friday, they're considered very boring. Breakfast is the one where we are allowed to have the same thing every day, and you're not considered weird.
Even though the scope for breakfast, particularly worldwide, is enormous, probably wider than other meals. The things that we consider acceptable breakfast foods is so wide-ranging.
Oh, it's extraordinary, isn't it? I remember the last, I don't do a lot of long haul travel. I remember one time I was out in Asia somewhere, and you go down to the breakfast buffet in the hotel, and you know, you're having dal and bread. Yeah, it's actually worked well for breakfast for me. I quite like that. But also, I think, you know, a lot of time it's time convenience. Yeah, now I have a very worthy looking breakfast. I always have some berries, some natural yogurt from some happy cows, or at least that's what they tell me. And some sort of very low sugar granola and some hazelnuts. I'm a bit of I'm a hazelnut nerd. I mean, you have to prioritize your spending on food, you know. And when it comes to ingredients, hazelnuts are things I'm prepared to pay more for. It's the Piedmont hazelnuts.
Oh, lovely.
Which, they are special. They taste like, you eat one of those and goes, this is what a roasted taste hazelnut should taste like.
This is the essence of hazelnut.
Exactly. So a few of them in the breakfast really elevates it. So yeah, it's that kind of thing. And some oats as well. Yeah, it seems worthy, but it's very tasty. It's not that's the point. I think that's the thing as well. A lot of really good healthy food is really tasty. I think I grew up in a culture where the association of healthiness was always with sort of the most bland, uninteresting stuff, you know. And I think that hopefully we're moving away from that now. Partly because we got off the idea of healthy being like, you know, low fat or whatever else it might be. I think we appreciate that it's quality of ingredients, et cetera, et cetera. And so, yeah, you can have plenty of olive oil smothered all over your whatever you're eating. That's not low fat, but that's good fat.
And are you a snacker? Do you have a go-to snack?
Oh God, I snack too much. I am slightly overweight, I have to say. I have to admit, but I once tried to lose it, and I had that backfire effect where you lose it and then it comes back on even more alarmingly quickly. So I dare not provoke my metabolic system again into thinking I'm starving it, because I think it might.
This is just where you are. Yeah, this is it.
I'm a pretty bad snacker. I have very high cocoa chocolate. I like 90%. Chocolate. I mean, that's good also because it tends to be quite self-limiting in the sense that you
don't want much of it, but full of antioxidants.
Oh yeah, and all that stuff, blah blah blah. It's nice anyway. I like nuts. In terms of like naughtier stuff, you know, I have sort of tried to eat a lot less cake, but I am a bit of a sucker for a pastry. And where I live in Bristol, unfortunately stroke fortunately, there are several places that make fantastic croissants. I find it very hard to walk past one of those places and not say, I'll have one of those, please.
I think that's just good sense, to be honest with you.
I think so, yeah. I tell myself they're low sugar. It's true, actually. A croissant hasn't got a lot of sugar in it. It's got a lot of white flour and a lot of butter.
Hey, I wrote a whole book on butter. I'm very pro-butter. So tell me about what you would cook if you had... Well, you said you still get together with the friends from university and cook together.
Yeah.
If they were coming round to yours...
We don't cook. We eat together. We don't cook together.
Yeah. Okay. Would you cook for friends? And if so, what's your sort of go-to hosting dish?
Yeah. We do cook for friends. The thing is, we're trying to work out whether it's correct that one should worry about, oh, I've made it for them before. I'm not sure one should worry about that. I mean, I sometimes find that, for example, we don't eat lamb. We sometimes would cook lamb because we like it, but don't cook it just for the two of us. And just like a slow roast lamb shoulder or lamb stew is really, really good. One thing I like to make, if I think people will appreciate it, is the squid in ink, which was I learned about when I was in the Basque Country after university. It's really nice. I mean, you can have it like as a pasta sauce, but you can also just have it as a stew. And that's the way I tend to do it, just some nice bread. And actually, it's really interesting. It looks very exotic, this really black dish, you know, with a squid in it. It's actually not difficult to make. So it kind of looks, it's got a mini kind of wow factor, but it's actually not difficult. I don't like doing very long, faffy stuff, I'm afraid.
You've got to know your guests well if you're doing squid and ink, though. I think you are pitching that to very specific people, aren't you?
Yeah, no, you're right. I have to check the people who be into that. But you're right. You're right.
But if they are, I mean, I would love to have squid and ink if I went to someone's house. But then I'm a trenchman. To finish, we always ask our guests the same question, which is, what is your desert island meal? And by that, I mean ultimate meal. I do not mean you have to fish on a desert island. I mean, this is your last, no holds barred, as big or as small as you fancy meal. What are you having?
Yeah. Oh, dearie me. It's interesting. I think I'm going to overanalyze it because in a way, you know, do you have the most sort of, in that situation, you're looking for like the most special meal or are you looking for the go-to thing, the one thing you'd always kind of have? So I'm going to give you a two-part answer. I think if it was the latter, I would probably go for some kind of pasta. I think I do love pasta. And, you know, I'd probably have something like, I don't know, actually. I very rarely have a good lasagna because of the meat issue. But someone make me a really good lasagna or venison ragu or something. But if it was like just a real nice treat, I would like to there's a restaurant in Bristol called Boxy, and I love it. It's tiny, and there's one guy in the kitchen called Elliot, and he does all the cooking himself, and his wife does front of house. And he's such a good cook. And it's simple, it's not fussy, but it's just, he has this knack of bringing out flavors. So I would like to say, just, you know, send me a takeout, whatever he's doing that day. And that would be a lovely way to go.
That sounds like a fantastic idea. Are you having a pudding or a croissant?
Well, I'd have his pudding again. You know, I don't normally have a pudding when I go out because I have to have some kind of control. But if I go there, I have to, because it's always going to be great. Yeah.
That is the highest recommendation for a single chef I think we've ever had. Just whatever you're doing, send it out to me. I'll have that. That's fantastic. Julian, thank you so much for joining Table Talk. And Julian's book, How the World Eats, A Global Food Philosophy, is published by Granta and available now.